From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, US war crimes. Rights groups accuse Obama's administration over deadly drone strikes. With 28 Greenpeace activists still in Russian detention, we speak to the head of the organization.
In all honest truth, we did not anticipate this level of response. Did we anticipate that we might get arrested? Yes, we did. We anticipate there might be trespass charges, which is the only law that we broke in our judgment. Yes, but certainly not piracy charges, which carry, these lengthy prison times.
We're in San Francisco for the latest as the transit workers' strike comes to an end. And unhealthy start, we look at the tech glitches that have plagued the healthcare law sign-up. That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif says that missile strikes from American drone aircraft have become a major irritant between his country and the United States. Ahead of his meeting with U.S. President Barack Obama, Prime Minister Sharif said he'd rather focus on trade, investment, and economic development. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
Washington has had a rocky relationship with Islamabad, and in a speech to the U.S. Institute of Peace, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif identified the key problem.
This issue has become a major irritant in our bilateral relationship as well. I would therefore stress the need for an end to drone attacks.
Instead of discussing how missile strikes from U.S. drone aircraft violate Pakistan's territorial integrity, as he put it, Prime Minister Sharif would much rather discuss with President Obama how the U.S. can help boost trade, investment, and economic development for Pakistan.
At talks in London, the Friends of Syria group, consisting of 11 Western and Arab nations, told Syrian opposition officials that their presence is essential during peace talks. It comes after one of the main groups of the Syrian opposition coalition threatened to boycott a meeting scheduled next month. UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
The West and their Middle East allies pressed Syria's opposition to put forward a united front at peace talks in Geneva due next month, known as the Geneva II. At the meeting in London, UK Foreign Secretary William Hague wanted to lay the groundwork for these talks in November, with ministers saying unity among the fractured Syrian opposition was necessary. They also stressed plans to bolster Syria's moderate opposition, which they deem essential to keeping extremists out of power. The Syrian National Council, a key group in the opposition, is unwilling to open dialogue with representatives of Bashar al-Assad's regime and threatened not to attend the talks in Geneva.
And Russian investigators allege the bus bomb explosion in Volgograd may have been planned to target Moscow, as indicated by the suicide bomber's bus ticket. 6 people have been killed, some 30 wounded, and 4 victims were flown to Moscow hospitals for emergency treatment. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Russian investigative committee spokesman said the suspected suicide bomber, identified as a 30-year-old Naida Siyalova, was traveling on an intercity bus from Makhachkala in Russia's southern Republic of Dagestan to Moscow. For unknown reasons, she got off in the suburbs of Volgograd on a bus stop close to the Interior Ministry Academy. Asiyalova was reportedly in a relationship with a 21-year-old Moscovite whom she had converted to radical Islam. The young man, believed to be an explosives expert, joined an extremist group in the Restive Republic of Dagestan and is wanted by local authorities for organizing 2 blasts in the republic's capital in May this year.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Employers in America hired fewer people in the month of September than expected, suggesting the U.S. economy's recovery may be losing some of its momentum. The disappointing job figures may also prompt the U.S. Federal Reserve to hold off on easing back on its stimulus program. Li Ling Tan has more from New York.
American employers created 148,000 jobs in September, significantly fewer than the 180,000 jobs economists were hoping for. The lower-than-expected job figures suggest America's modest economic recovery may be losing steam and gives the U.S. central bank more cause to hold off on phasing out its massive bond purchases. While job numbers were disappointing, the upside from the report was a dip in the unemployment rate, which fell slightly to 7.2%. The lowest in 5 years. The jobs report from the U.S. Department of Labor was released Tuesday, some 2 weeks later than scheduled due to the partial government shutdown.
and fires continue to rage in Australia. Fire conditions are expected to be as bad as it gets, with mass school closures and a threat to property and life. Officials are pleading for anyone without a reason to be in Australia's Blue Mountains to stay away, as Arthur Stevens reports.
The warning comes as firefighters prepare to face an active 1,500-kilometre fire edge in the Blue Mountains in strong winds and soaring temperatures. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner, Shane Fitzsimmons, says Wednesday's weather conditions will be worse than initially feared. He says that means the fire danger rating across most of the Greater Sydney area, the Hunter Valley to the north and the fireground areas of the Blue Mountains to the west and Southern Highlands are going to be widespread extreme fire danger ratings. All schools across the Blue Mountains are closed and state forests in Sydney, the Greater Hunter, the Central West and the Southern Highlands will be closed because of the high fire danger.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington. Welcome to FSN Reports. Two major reports on the United States' use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen contradict claims that the government is following international law and protecting civilian life. The reports from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch come just days before the United Nations discusses two reports of its own, criticizing the lethal drone strikes and calling for greater transparency. As Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif meets with President Obama this week to discuss the nation's future relationship, the reports fault both governments for failing to protect human life and compensate the families of those involved. In Washington, Alice Ulstein has more.
President Obama has repeatedly defended the escalation of drone strikes in countries where the U.S. has not declared war, mainly in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, as a lawful piece of the global war against terrorist groups. But after months of research, including interviews with surviving family members of drone strike victims and eyewitnesses on the ground in Pakistan, Amnesty International's Mustafa Kadri identified at least 30 civilians killed in four attacks last year alone, as well as multiple cases where capture of the target was possible but not attempted. While they were only able to fully investigate 9 of the nearly 50 strikes carried out in Pakistan in 2012, Kadri told reporters in Washington Tuesday that among those cases, they identified possible war crimes.
On a sunny afternoon in October 2012, a 68-year-old woman, Mamuna Bibi, was killed in a drone strike that appears to have been directly targeted at her. Her grandchildren recounted in painful detail to Amnesty International the moment when she was blown into pieces in front of their very eyes while she was gathering vegetables. Almost a year to the day, her family has yet to receive any acknowledgement from the US that she was killed by one of its drones, let alone any justice or compensation for her killing.
Based on data from the Pakistani government and international NGOs, Amnesty's report estimates that between 400 and 900 civilians have been killed by drones in Pakistan since 2004. And in its own investigation release this week, Human Rights Watch found at least 57 civilians killed by drones in Yemen since 2009. At Tuesday's press conference, Andrea Prasso with Human Rights Watch said the U.S. government has repeatedly refused to verify or contradict any independent counts of civilian deaths or disclose the legal justification for the strikes.
The U.S. government has also refused to disclose who it believes it's at war with. The U.S. has said it's in an armed conflict with al-Qaeda and associated forces, but has not disclosed who those associated forces are. So the United States has a set of secret rules about when it can kill its enemies and a secret list of those enemies.
In a new report scheduled to be discussed at the UN General Assembly this Friday, Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Ben Emmerson also criticized the U.S. government for creating, quote, an almost insurmountable obstacle to transparency. He calls on the Obama administration to declassify as much information as possible about the drone program, including its own data on civilian deaths and the methodology behind those numbers. The UN General Assembly also plans to discuss another report on drones from Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions, Christoph Haines, who urges the UN Security Council to take a stronger role in supervising the use of armed drones around the world. Nareen Shah with Amnesty International told reporters Tuesday that the Obama administration is currently setting a global precedent.
You know, drone technology is proliferating rapidly. And the U.S. government should be careful about the signal that it's sending to the rest of the world. Is killing people with drone technology, with impunity, with secrecy, with a failure at any accountability, the message that the Obama administration wants to send to all other governments that will acquire this technology?
On Wednesday, Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif will meet with President Obama at the White House to discuss the future of the drone program, among other issues. Though Sharif has publicly called the strikes a violation of his country's sovereignty, Amnesty International called out his administration in their report for failing to protect Pakistani citizens from the strikes and failing to demand reparations and accountability for the civilian victims. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And as mentioned by my colleague Alice Olstein, Prime Minister Sharif is in Washington, and ahead of tomorrow's meeting with Barack Obama, he addressed an audience at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
In my first statement to the Parliament, I had reiterated our strong commitment to ensuring an end to the drone attacks. More recently, our political parties in a national conference had declared that the use of drones is not only a continued violation of our territorial integrity, but also detrimental to our resolve and efforts at eliminating terrorism. I would therefore stress the need for an end to drone attacks. Leaving behind the baggage of trust deficit and mutual suspicions. Instead, cooperation in key areas including trade, investment, energy, technology, education, and agriculture under the rubric of strategic dialogue should be the main plank of our partnership. As large democracies, there should be greater interaction between our two countries, not only at the parliamentary level, but through exchange of businessmen, students, opinion makers, and tourism, as these would help remove many of our misperceptions. The vibrant community of Pakistani Americans is playing an important role in bringing our two nations closer. I am thankful to them as they constitute a permanent link between our two countries that can and should play an important role in eliminating the negative perceptions.
A group of 28 Greenpeace activists and two journalists remain in detention in Russia after they were arrested following their protest near a Gazprom-owned oil rig on September 18th. The activists are being held in the northern Russian city of Murmansk. They have been charged with piracy, an offence that carries a 15-year sentence in Russia. I spoke to the executive director of Greenpeace International, Kumi Naidu, who told me protest is never without risk.
Be prepared to face the consequences of our peaceful civil disobedience activities, not dissimilar to the civil rights movement in the United States or the anti-apartheid movement in my country, South Africa. What we are opposed to is these disproportionate charges of piracy, which President Putin himself said is inappropriate. And in fact, the president of the state body, the Russian Human Rights Council, actually said on Friday last week that accusing Greenpeace of piracy is just as crazy as accusing us of trying to gang rape the oil platform. And the worst case scenario as we stand is that if these charges go forward, piracy can fetch as much as 15 years in prison.
The many activists at Greenpeace, and especially those who actively take part in these protests, they accept that breaking the law is an inevitable part of this form of protest.
Sure. Peaceful civil disobedience is a critical part of democracy, which allows citizens to be able to bring their views to bear on public debate. And therefore, we do not make any apologies, especially when we would say that our peaceful act of civil disobedience was proportionate to the risk that the climate science is clearly saying to us, which is 75% of known oil, coal and gas reserves need to stay where they are if we are to avert catastrophic climate change, and certainly those in the most riskiest environments such as the Arctic.
The people who volunteered for this particular mission, were they aware, were you aware of the risks, the legal risks, and how hard Russian authorities would come down on you?
Well, last year, Greenpeace did exactly the same action over 7 days at the same rig. I personally participated in that action. The Coast Guard was there. They observed our peaceful protests. They noticed that we were not causing any danger to either property or person, and they refused to intervene when the Gazprom security asked them to. So if anything, in terms of our assessments, we would have anticipated not a worse scenario than what we faced last year, which was the Coast Guard observed and refused to intervene, even though they were being berated by Gazprom security that they should. So in all honest truth, we did not anticipate this level of response. Did we anticipate that we might get arrested? Yes, we did. Did we anticipate there might be trespass charges, which is the only law that we broke in our judgment? Yes, but certainly not piracy charges, which carry, you know, these lengthy prison times.
Has this been damaging for Greenpeace, or do you think it's done the opposite? Do you think it's made people more determined?
People believe that we are running out of time. Our activists and volunteers are extremely well trained in nonviolent civil disobedience, and they know that their actions can invite a negative reaction from governments that sometimes protect companies engaged in environmental crime rather than either standing up for the majority of people or for the environment. I have to say, so far, we have been overwhelmed by the solidarity that we've received from Nobel Peace Laureates, Hillary Clinton coming out last week Friday saying that there should be a global outrage, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, as well as the Brazilian President speaking out for their release and so on. So the important thing is that during this time, many people are asking the question, why is the Arctic important? How does it impact us, those that live far away, and so on? So at one level, the actual campaign of stopping oil production in the Arctic before it starts has continued to be heard across the world as our activist language in prison. But right now, of course, our priority is to get people back home to their families, and that's what we are very heavily focused on. If anything, I think this year does not present Greenpeace in a bad light. I think it raises questions about how the Russian authorities have actually responded to what was a peaceful protest and what one in which they responded in a completely different manner 12 months ago.
The Greenpeace UK director, John Sovan, he said, Russia has sent us a clear signal over the Arctic. We need a more creative way to get our story across. Do you agree that Greenpeace needs to reevaluate its approach?
I agree that climate activism has to have a more creative message and strategy to get our message across. It's for two reasons. One is the science is telling us we are running out of time. And if we are to secure our children and grandchildren's futures, we have to move, you know, much faster. And current strategies are not delivering as fast progress as we need. For any major action that we have, we evaluate what we can learn from it. Reflect on how the particular peaceful protest played out. And then on the basis of that, you know, look at whether we need to adjust our strategy and so on. That is certainly something that we will be doing. However, I would say to all governments and all big companies that are driving climate pollution, that if governments think that by using disproportionate repression and incarceration and so on, that they're going to intimidate us, I would My friendly advice to them would be that they should rethink that.
Head of Greenpeace International, Kumi Naidu. Now, only 3 weeks into the six-month period, the federal government has allowed for people to sign up for health insurance, and millions have been frustrated by the enrolment process. Signing up online has exposed several glitches in the federal government system, faults Republican opponents have jumped on to attack the healthcare legislation. Alicia Wilson, who runs La Clinica del Pueblo in Washington, D.C., a healthcare facility that assists the capital's area's low-income families, spoke to FSN's Andrea Straubmuller.
Everybody's having problems with the glitches in the system. I think the level of frustration is not enormous because our team expected sort of a slow rollout. We had some heads up earlier on that not every aspect of the different marketplaces was going to be fully functional at the beginning. And so we really focused most of our early energies, and what we're doing right now is focusing on educating the community and recruiting the community into our enrollment staff and our enrollment services, but not focusing so much on completing applications because of the glitches and because it's actually a very complex process. We don't want anybody to rush into making decisions. So, yes, there's been some frustration, but there's also a lot of understanding that this is an incredibly complex process, and it will take time.
Do you think that these faults are part of the process of implementing an entire new system? Or do you think, like some critics of this healthcare reform have been saying, that these flaws are basically unacceptable?
I think the way the law was written makes it an exceedingly complex endeavor, unprecedented. I don't think there's been anything like this ever. And certainly technologically, the demands that were written into the law that the marketplace would meet are just extraordinary. So I think many of us were not surprised that there were glitches. Are they unacceptable? I'd say that the complexity of the law was maybe unacceptable. From La Clínica del Pueblo standpoint, we would have preferred health reform that would have a single-payer system that would be significantly simpler and wouldn't have so much difficulty. But the law as it's written, I think the glitches are understandable and they will get fixed.
Do you think that maybe later on down the road, once this technological aspect of healthcare reform in the system is solved, people will have to face yet another problem, which are basically the complexities that you are mentioning in the law as a system, as a law?
I think for the end user, for the people who are enrolling in insurance, the complexities are really on the front end, and the benefits will become apparent almost instantaneously. Yes, it's complex. Yes, there are a lot of considerations. From La Clínica del Pueblo standpoint, we're working with a lot of people who have never had insurance, so they don't understand the language of insurance, and they need to learn that. You know, what is a copay? What's a deductible? What's an out-of-pocket expense cap or what have you? Those are new language and new. It's a new environment for a lot of people.
Andrea Straubmuller talking to Alicia Wilson. An agreement's been reached over a rapid transit worker strike which crippled the San Francisco Bay Area for 4 days. The six-month dispute will be resolved if union members approve a deal reached with the management of the Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART. From San Francisco, Rachel Silverman reports.
The four-day strike caused chaos for the 400,000 people who ride BART most days, and it cost San Francisco Bay Area businesses millions of dollars. Saul Almanza is the vice president of the local chapter of the Service Employees International Union.
We understand that the strike has been an incredible inconvenience to the Bay Area commuters. The BART workers are raising issues at the bargaining table that are important to all workers in the region. BART workers, just like other workers, just want to be able to afford to live in the Bay Area. We want to thank the thousands of Bay Area workers who stood by us so we could win a contract that puts the safety and well-being of riders and workers first.
The tentative agreement covers compensation, health care, and safety issues. As this most recent strike ends, the National Transportation Safety Board's James Southworth is investigating an accident over the weekend in which two track workers were killed when they were hit by a train during routine inspections.
We'll look at training procedures. We'll look at past training. We'll look at the 72-hour history of everybody involved. We won't leave any stone unturned.
BART officials say a manager operating the train was an experienced operator and that the train was on automatic mode at the time. NTSB investigators say the operator was a trainee. SEIU negotiator Antoinette Bryant.
I am here to announce that we have reached a tentative agreement with BART, but I don't want it to be forgotten that two lives were lost during this time. And I want those families to be remembered, and I want them to know that we continue to extend our heartfelt condolences to them and their families.
During two recent strikes, commuters have sought alternatives to the 104 miles of commuter train lines, clogging roads, buses, and ferry services.
We did not want to strike, and we are glad to have a tentative agreement that we feel will work for all parties. We will go back to work and continue our efforts to keep the Bay Area moving.
Since unions made $100 million in concessions in 2009, when the system was in deficit, ridership has increased, bringing in a $125 million surplus, which BART contends needs to be used to pay for new rail cars and other improvements. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
Western nations and their Middle East allies pressed Syria's opposition to put forward a united front at peace talks in Geneva next month, known as Geneva 2. Foreign ministers promised to back a UN-led peace process in Syria to establish a transitional governmental body that would be mutually agreed. Our correspondent Natalie Powell has the latest.
Known as the Friends of Syria group, 11 Western and Arab nation representatives ended talks in London, reaffirming the need for a transitional government body in Syria, which will be formed by mutual consent. They hope to open dialogue on this at Geneva 2 in November, a second round of peace talks to lead on from a first round in June 2012. As UK Foreign Secretary William Hague explained.
First, we agreed that we would put our united and collective weight behind the UN-led Geneva II process, which must lead to establishing by mutual consent a transitional governing body with full executive powers. That is set out in the Geneva Communique of June 2012. And by definition, mutual consent means that it can only be agreed with the consent of the Syrian National Coalition. So Assad would play no role.
US Secretary of State John Kerry is hopeful that the meeting in Switzerland will take place as planned to help bring an end to the civil war which has been ongoing in the country since 2011.
I don't know anybody, including the Russians and others in the region who are not part of the support group, who believe that there is a military solution to this conflict. It is clear that both sides will continue to fight and to fight and to fight. And in the end, the greatest victims, the people who suffer the most, are the Syrian people themselves, who are being driven from their homes and killed in the most wanton violence, and who are having an increasingly profound impact on surrounding countries that are seeing their lives affected as a consequence of the outflow of refugees.
Both the UK Foreign Secretary and his US counterpart John Kerry said there would be no successful second conference in Geneva without the removal of President Bashar al-Assad. The Friends of Syria group meeting in London also pushed Syrian opposition officials to attend the Geneva II talks, saying their presence would be needed for the peace process to go ahead, though no confirmation of whether an agreement has been reached was given.
But we believe that the London 11 that came together today, Europeans and Arabs, Turks, members of this support group, came together and all agreed that it is imperative that we try to get to the negotiating table and try to save the lives and to save the existence of the state of Syria itself.
The Friends of Syria group urged their support to the opposition, stressing that huge efforts were being made to bring all sides to the negotiating table, though whether they will succeed won't be known until next month. Natalie Powell, London.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the show. Our email address, reports@featurestory.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Wednesday, the United Nations push for a DRC peace deal. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.